We are starting a new series today. It's a series on Samuel. And he is one of the key characters of the Old Testament. He was a man who stood in the gap. There was a time in Israel's history when they were between a bad place and a bad place, and they needed somebody to step in and fill in for God. And Samuel was that man. And we're going to see how, right from the time that he was conceived in the womb until the day he died, how God was at work in history, or in the history of Israel, and also in his life, shaping him and molding him and developing him and into the man of God that he became and the leader of Israel that he became. It's an amazing story. I've got this Sunday and next Sunday, and then I'm on holidays. So then Jonathan, Pastor John, is going to take the next 3 weeks after that. And then we'll conclude it with another couple of weeks, wrap it up on Labor Day Sunday. Sometimes, you know, in the course of history, people live through very stormy times. They may be times of economic hardship. They may be times of political instability. They may be times of famine. They may be times of disease and illness, widespread illness. It may be a time of war. It might be a time of a natural disaster, like that tsunami that we saw 10 years ago in Indonesia that killed 250,000 people. I remember as a child growing up hearing my parents talk about life in the Depression and how tough that was. My dad getting on the bus with his mother and going down to the golf course to find golf balls that they could sell to the golfers so that they could buy a loaf of bread to have supper that night. And then after the Depression came the war, when they said goodbye to friends and family that went overseas to fight and some of them never returning. And the hardships that were going on. And just getting that awareness and that impression during those growing up years of what it meant for them, what it meant for my parents to have a faith in God that carried them through those times. I was thinking about this as I was preparing the sermon, and I just thought of this world in the last 100 years. What has happened in this world in the last 100 years from 1915 to the present day? Well, 1915, World War I had just started. And World War I resulted in the deaths of 15 million people. 15 million people. By the way, these are conservative estimates. I went and did some searching on this, and there's low-end numbers and there's high-end numbers. I took the low end. 15 million people killed in World War I. Just at the end of World War I, the Russian Civil War broke out when the Bolsheviks overthrew the Tsar. There were 9 million people killed during that conflict. Something that lots of us don't hear about is at the end of World War I, 1918-19 and around there, the Spanish flu, the influenza, swept around the world. Because there was no vaccine or antidote to that at that time, 30 million people were killed, died as a result of the Spanish flu. No sooner did they get over that, when 1939 came along and World War II broke out, 60 million people killed in World War II. And remember, these are conservative numbers. Stalin, the Russian dictator, rose to power in 1923, and during his time in power for about 25 years, he killed 20 million people. Mao Zedong, the communist ruler of China, killed 30 million people. By the way, when you look at those numbers, 60 million killed in World War II, 20 million under Stalin, 30 million under Mao Zedong. That's 110 million people killed by the influence of three anti-God ideologues. People say, oh, religion has caused most of the deaths around the world because of violence and war. It's not religion. Three atheists killed more people in 50 years than religious wars killed in the previous 1,500 years. The Korean War after World War II, 1950 to 1953, I think about that and I realize, man, that's when I was born. And 3 million people died in the Korean War. Just from World War I in 1914 to the Korean War in 1953, 167 million people. That's astounding. Those were stormy times. And then since the Korean War, since 1953, we've had the oppression of North Korea, we've had the genocide in Rwanda, we've had the Vietnamese War, we've had the Cambodian War, we've had the Laotian War. There's been uprisings in the Congo, in Ethiopia, in Sudan. There's the Nigeria. Remember the Biafran War in the 1970s? There was the Bangladesh revolution against Pakistan where they broke away. There was war in Afghanistan and Iran, Iraq. Now there's civil war in Syria. This world is in turmoil. And it seems that it always has been and always will be. These are stormy times. Now, fortunately, thank God that Canada is like an island of stability in the midst of the storm. But we often wonder, I often wonder, how long is it going to stay like that? We don't know. And even if there are not the global wars that we are, and the global storms of war and so on, that we in Canada are caught up with, yet in our own personal lives, there might be a lot of unrest and stormy times. And I think in these situations, we can learn lessons from Samuel. Samuel was born into stormy times in Israel. And we're going to see how God worked through him. We're going to see how in all of this upheaval that was taking place in the land of Israel during these days of Samuel, he was like a fixed point. You know, when everything is falling apart around you, when everything is in upheaval around you, you need to have a fixed point that you can come back to get your bearings. That's why Sunday morning worship is so important. When you think of the issues that you're confronting all week long at work and with finances and with family and with noisy neighbors and cars that break down and roofs that are leaking and all the things that are going on around you, it's nice to be able to just come together on a Sunday like this and sing songs that we know talk about a God who doesn't move, a God who loves us no matter what. We hear from his word, the solid, steady word of God that focuses us again on that fixed point. Samuel was that person in Israel. And you know what? You might be that fixed point in the life of somebody else. Somebody at work who's going through all kinds of turmoil in their lives, in their life. And you might be that person who's that solid individual that they're able to look to and draw encouragement from. We don't know. We never know. That's why it's so important for us to be faithful to our calling to God, as Samuel was in his day, as we will see. And we'll see how Samuel guided Israel through a whole transition from a time of really anarchy, when there was no king and no ruler in place, to a time when finally David was able to step into the throne of Israel and establish some order out of the chaos and bring Israel to the point that they had some strength and some stability. Well, the sermon today is called Faith in Stormy Times. And the first thing that we want to look at is just to kind of get a picture of what these stormy times were like in Israel at this during this time of Samuel. And I'm calling this Israel's predicament. The nation of Israel was in a predicament. We couldn't even call them a nation. It was just a bunch of settlements of 12 tribes scattered over the land of what is now Israel. And it was a time of lack of direction, lack of order, lack of stability. Israel's predicament, the first thing that we see is there was social decay in the land. Social decay is when the rules and the social mores of a culture start to unravel. You know, those of you that are old enough, and that's a lot of us here today, back in the 60s, you remember the day of the age of revolution. You know, all these young people were saying, we want to be free, we're going to have a revolution. And the songs of revolution came out, and the songs of social revolution and so forth started coming out, and it's funny how we sing them today. We hear them today, and they're the oldie goldies, right? Back then, they were revolutionary, rebellious songs against the established order of society. We heard such things about free love. Now, do it whenever you want, with whoever you want. Do your own thing. That was a phrase that came out. Just do your own thing. Be yourself. Do whatever you want. If it feels good, do it. If you want to do it, go ahead. You know, whatever it might be. And there was all kinds of social upheaval in the land. I remember thinking about that and thinking, what are they talking about? We want to be free. We're free. You know, you can live wherever you want. You can go wherever you want. You can work wherever you want. You can spend your money on whatever you want. You can marry whoever you want. This is a free country. What was their cry of freedom all about? The cry of freedom that they had was rebellion against any kind of establishment, order, or rules, or regulations that they perceived was inhibiting their total free expression of choice. Well, you know what? That's the kind of situation that Samuel was born into. A couple books ahead of 1 Samuel is the book of Judges. And it said, the last verse of Judges says this: in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. That's anarchy. That's total lack of rules and order. Everyone did as he saw fit. They did their own thing. They did whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, to whoever they wanted. Kind of like when, in grade 3, the teacher leaves the room. Suddenly the whole place erupts, and talking and laughing and shoving and throwing of books and papers and everything. You know, that kind of a situation leads to moral depravity. It leads to social instability. Basically, people were just making up the rules as they went. Imagine living in that kind of society. Second thing that we see in Israel's predicament was that there was behavioral decay. People were acting rudely and lewdly. Individual standards just fell by the wayside. You know, as I read commentators and analysts and so on today, news analysts, social analysts and so on, one of the complaints that we hear a lot of is this: that society today is getting coarser. Coarser and ruder all the time. And all you have to do is go on to a few open forums on social media or internet sites to see what I mean by that. The language that we hear being used, all kinds of swearing, words that would never be allowed in polite company. My wife and I went to Boston Pizza Patio a couple weeks ago to enjoy a nice summer evening meal. The guys behind us, the conversation, first of all, the topic of conversation was lewd, and their words that they were using were rude and coarse. And I thought, you know, public place like this, where you come to have an enjoyable meal. Entertainment is getting raunchier by the day, it seems. The clothing people wear. You know, I was in Kildonan Place Mall Friday night. Shelley and I were there to pick something up, and as we were walking out, and I kind of had this sermon going through my mind, I was just looking at the t-shirts that people were wearing and the things that were being said on the t-shirts. You know, and just three that I recall, that the one that caught my eye right off the bat was, guy was wearing this big thing, Thug Life. I went home and Googled Thug Life. Apparently, it's a line of t-shirts. It's a company called Thug Life T-shirts. You can order them online with all kinds of sayings on them. The only problem is that those sayings that are on the t-shirts are filled with swear words. And people wear these up front, just walking down the mall with this kind of language written on their shirts. I saw another shirt that had total destruction with skulls and swords and flames coming up. Total destruction. Is that the guy's mantra? Is that what he lives by in his life? Total destruction? Sons of Anarchy, another one. Yeah. You know, what kinds of, and these people are walking down through the mall with their kids, you know, wearing these kinds of t-shirts. And we just look at them nowadays and say, oh, there's another one. Don't tell me that society has not degenerated from what it was 50 years ago. In Samuel's day, the behavioral decay we see evident here in this little scene with Hannah in the tabernacle. Hannah, of course, as Nancy read for us the story there, the introductory story of Hannah, she was one of two wives. She was probably Elkanah's first wife, and because she couldn't produce a son for Elkanah, he married a second wife named Peninnah. Peninnah had children. Hannah couldn't have any children. And so there's this tormenting going on that Peninnah would constantly be provoking Hannah and taunting her with the fact that she could provide Elkanah with children. Hannah couldn't. And Hannah, in her grief and the burden of her heart and the grief of her soul, was praying, pouring out her heart to God one day at the altar. And it says that she was praying in her heart as they were on their trip, their annual trip to the tabernacle. And her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk. Eli's the chief priest of the tabernacle. He thought she was drunk. Now, Eli's living in this era of social decay and moral decay and so on and so forth. And he's probably seen this all kinds of times in the tabernacle. Oh, these people, they come from all these little villages around town, you know, around the area. They come to the tabernacle. They got money to spend. They're meeting up with other friends. They're having parties all night. And they're drinking and they're getting drunk. And then they come to the tabernacle and they worship God and they're drunk. That's what's kind of going through Eli's mind. So he goes in and finally he just, in exasperation, says to Hannah, How long will you keep on getting drunk? Get rid of your wine, woman. She said, No, you don't understand. And then she explained the situation to him. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that Eli, he didn't look at her and see her lips moving and think that she was some godly woman. He thought she was drunk because he'd seen so much behavioral decay in the society around him. That's the first thing that came to his mind when he saw her there in the tabernacle. There was religious decay that was happening in Israel at that time. There were certain rules for how the priests got their support. See, every tribe had an allotment of land in the nation of Israel with farms, and they could set up manufacturing or do whatever they did, builders and so forth. Mostly farming, of course, in that generation, in that day and age. But the Levites, they didn't have a land portion, and so the way that they were supported was through the gifts that were given to the tabernacle. And they had different rules and regulations for how they would get their food and their supplies of meat and so on. And you can read about them in the book of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. There were certain, as the worshippers would bring their animal to the tabernacle for sacrifice. They would sacrifice it, and then the priests got a certain portion. Well, the way that they did it back in Eli's day, the rules had kind of changed a little bit, was that they would put the meat into the pot, which is boiling, and then the priests would throw in this big treble hook, and they would haul it. Whatever they hauled out was theirs. And that those were part of the rules for how the priests would get their share of meat. Well, look at this little encounter. Okay, in 1 Samuel chapter 2. But even before the fat was burned, the servant of the priest would come to the worshiper and he would say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give the priest some meat to roast. He won't accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." Well, I guess, you know, if I had my choice, I'd rather buy raw meat than boiled meat too. But that's not the point here, that they were violating the rules. If the man said to him, "Let the fat be burned up first," because that was what the law required, was that the fat would be burned up before the Lord, and then what was left could be given to the priest. "Then take whatever you want." The servant would then answer, "No, hand it over now. If you don't, I'll take it by force." These servants of the priests were violating the rules of the tabernacle to get their masters the best cuts of meat. And the issue here is really that the priests were taking their share before they gave God his share. They were trying to get their cut first before the worshiper had a chance to offer his sacrifice to the Lord. The religious rules were falling apart and were decaying. There was moral decay in the land. Moral decay. You know, when leaders talk one way and act another way, it's called hypocrisy. Of course, that's true of everybody, not just leaders. If you talk one way and act a different way, that's called hypocrisy. Hophni and Phinehas were the sons of Eli, and they were the two priests who kind of administered everything that happened at the tabernacle there. Well, they were guilty of hypocrisy of the worst sort. We read again in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Now Eli, who was very old, heard about everything his sons were doing to all Israel and how they slept with the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. These women who would come to the tabernacle to serve in the church. Imagine a woman coming and saying, you know, I want to serve here at the church. Is there something I can do? You know, I can do some vacuuming, I can do some cleaning, I can do some typing, I can do some filing. Is there something that I can do? They want to serve the Lord. And Hophni and Phinehas were taking advantage of that situation, taking sexual advantage of those women. Hypocrisy of the worst sort. They were supposed to represent a holy and pure God. They were supposed to teach people the way of righteousness. And they were engaging in this crassly immoral behavior, adopting pagan practices because temple prostitutes were part of the worship of Baal and Chemosh and Asherah and all these other foreign gods. Temple prostitution was something that happened all the time there. It didn't happen in the tabernacle of holy God. So there was moral decay of the worst sort that was going on in Israel at that time. There was governmental or political decay. You can call that whatever you want. But you know, when the political or governmental system breaks down, then there's anarchy in the land. We've seen that happen in countries around the world today. In 1 Samuel chapter 4, and I'm really just pulling out little snapshots of a whole story here. If you go home and read the first few chapters of 1 Samuel, you kind of get the whole context of what was going on. But we read that there was a war between Israel and the Philistines, and says, so the Philistines fought and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So the most holy piece of furniture out of the tabernacle was gone into the hands of pagan heathens. And the two leaders of Israel, bad as they were, the two leaders of Israel, Hophni and Phinehas, were dead. And the whole government was breaking apart, breaking down. It was a national disaster. The future was totally bleak. And into this situation, there's one young boy in the tabernacle who's serving God. Lastly, there's in terms of Israel's predicament, there's this spiritual decay that's going on. And I guess we could have put this at the very beginning and said, because of the spiritual decay, all these other things happened. But spiritual decay, this really sums it up. You know, Israel was really just a shadow of what God had intended for them to be. When you think of their history, you think back to the glorious deliverance of Israel out of Egypt. You think about them in the Sinai wilderness there, the giving of the law of God from the holy mountain of Sinai. There was the amazing crossing of the Jordan River into the land. There were the stunning victories of Joshua as they encountered the forces that they came up against. There were great men of faith and leadership during the times of the judges, and now there was nothing left. Historically and nationally, Israel was on the verge of disappearing off of the face of the earth. They were just these scattered tribes across this whole land with a destroyed, gutted religious and governmental system, and they were in danger of being destroyed, of being gone, of disappearing. Phinehas's wife, when that last battle, when Hophni and Phinehas took the Ark of the Covenant out into battle against the Philistines, and that they were all killed, that I just read for you there, and the Ark was captured, and Hophni and Phinehas were killed. Phinehas's wife was expecting a child. She was ready to give birth. And we read here that she had a difficult labor, and she actually ended up dying after the labor. But they said, oh, you've got a son. You've got a son, and you should be rejoicing. And the women around her were happy. But Phinehas' wife said this. She named the boy Ichabod. How would you like that name? Ichabod means no glory. No glory. She named the boy Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel. Because the capture of the Ark of God and the deaths of her father-in-law and her husband, she said, the glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured. And that one last dying breath of that woman, as she named her son, as she gave him that name, she was declaring the total hopelessness of Israel's situation. That's the kind of situation that Samuel was born into. Well, God has provision. He always has provision for his people. So how is God going to provide for Israel's need? Is he going to suddenly cause a great leader to ride down from the mountains on a white horse with a sword over his head and gather the people together for a great military campaign? Is that what he's going to do? Or maybe there'd be some powerful miracle, some thunder and lightning from heaven and some floods and earthquakes and everything else. Maybe that'll happen. Maybe there'd be some kind of amazing deliverance. What's God going to do? Well, the fact is God was already at work in the heart and the life of a humble, devout woman named Hannah. This woman who was in travail of spirit and grief of heart, who would come to this tabernacle year after year after year and pray for one thing, a son. That's all she wanted. Just give me a son. God was working in her heart. And in her and through her, he was setting the stage for the instrument that he would use to help Israel in their time of need. There would be no great display of power or miraculous deliverance. Not that God can't do it. God could do a miracle anytime he wants. But understand this. God uses means. God uses natural human means to accomplish his will. Yes, there are times he stepped in and performed miracles. But 99% of the time, God, even in the midst of very difficult situations, he calls us to be faithful to him while he continues to do his work in this life and in that life and through this situation and that situation as you continue to move forward step by tiny step of faith, following after him to discover his will. It's kind of like me saying, I really love, you know, big, beautiful, majestic oak trees. Man, they're beautiful things. And I would love to have one of those, you know, in my backyard. And I say that to somebody and they say, you want an oak tree in your backyard? Yeah, you know, one of those great big ones with big branches all over the place. And he says, okay, here you go. And he hands me an acorn. Start with that. You see, so many times in our life, we want God to do something big and miraculous and, you know, come to the rescue and show all those pagans, you know, who he really is. And God says, no. He says, I'm just going to keep working in your life, bit by bit, to provide for you what you need. And here's where we can learn some lessons from Hannah, and we will run through these quickly. The first lesson is this. Be steadfast in the expression of your faith. Steadfastness, that's one of the themes we're going to be talking about in the life of Samuel. Steadfastness in the time of storm and difficult times. Be steadfast in the expression of your faith. We read how year after year, this man, Elkanah, went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh. Went to the tabernacle year after year. Every year he was there with his family. Every year he gave them sacrifices. It was this habitual expression of devotion and faith to the Lord. I just find this heartwarming. It's a heartwarming description of a husband and wife devoted to each other and to God. Elkanah was faithful in the practice of his spiritual life. He was steadfast in his expression, an example of this to the family. Hannah was steadfast in her devotion to God, even out of her brokenness of heart and spirit. And the two of them together would worship with their family as they came to the tabernacle year after year. Steadfastness of expression of your faith. Coming to church is part of that. That's steadfastness. Just coming week after week, setting aside this time for worship because this is important. Setting aside regular time for your devotion with God, your Bible study and prayer time with the Lord. whatever it is, that steadfast expression of your faith needs to be there. The second thing that we see is this, and I've changed that. It says up there, maintain personal devotion. I would say declare. Declare your personal devotion to the Lord. I changed that wording just last night, so it's nobody's fault. Declare your personal devotion to the Lord. And here we have, of course, the example of Hannah, who as she prayed, she made this vow. Samuel, 1 Samuel 1:11 says, she made a vow saying, O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head. The no razor used on his head, that goes back to the days of the Nazarite vow, when it was a sign of separation unto God that a man would let his hair grow. Samson, remember, he was separated to the Lord for the Lord's service and the Lord's work. And there were three aspects of that Nazarite vow. They could not cut their hair, they could not drink strong drink, beer or wine, and they could not touch a dead body. They were to keep themselves separate from those things, just as an indication of the fact that they were dedicated to the service of God. And this is what Hannah is saying in her vow. She's declaring her personal devotion to God by saying, if you give me a son, I will see that he is set apart for your service. You give me this thing that I want more than anything else in the world, and I won't even keep him. I'll give him to you. I'll give him up. That's her devotion. And she declared it to God. This prayer of hers is a reflection of the great need in her life. It's a reflection of the deep devotion in her life. This prayer of hers is not to be used as an example of how we can somehow negotiate with God to get what we want. Because remember, she wasn't negotiating to get something that she wanted to keep. She was negotiating, if you will, that word, with God to say, give me something that I can give back to you. She was willing to give it up. I think of the James, who says, you pray and you don't get what you want. Why? Because you just want to consume it. You want the money to spend on yourself. You want the food to eat yourself. You want the house to be able to live in yourself. You pray for all these things. Oh, God, give me this, give me that, give me this. And he says, it just so that you can consume it upon your own lusts. God's not going to give you anything for that, he says. But here Hannah is saying, give it to me and I'll give it back to you. Let me win that lottery, and I'll put $55 million in the offering plate next Sunday. This is the point here, that the thing that Hannah wanted the most, she was willing to give back to God. Man, what kind of devotion is that? What has God given you that you can give back to him? Well, tell you one thing, he's given you life. He's given you yourself, your own life, and you can give that back to him. He's given you money. We need money to live, obviously. We spend it, look around us, we spend lots of money on ourselves. No question about that. There's always more that we can give back to him. He's given you gifts and talents, skills, ability to use your hands, ability to work with numbers, ability to sing. You can give that back to him. There are all kinds of things that we can give back to him to declare and express our personal devotion to the Lord. The last thing is this. Once you've made that commitment, once you've made that devotion or that declaration, then fulfill that commitment to the Lord. One of the most touching passages of Scripture is this, in 1 Samuel 1:24. After Hannah went back from that prayer and before they came back to the tabernacle the next year, guess what? She got pregnant and she gave birth to a son, named him Samuel. So that year, she didn't come with Elkanah to the tabernacle. And the next year, she didn't come with Elkanah to the tabernacle. She didn't come to the tabernacle with Elkanah and the rest of her family until Samuel was ready to be left there by himself. And Bible scholars argue about when that was. Was it when he was 3? Was it when he was 4? When he was 5? Whenever he could have taken care of himself. I'm sure she didn't want to drop off a baby or a child there that Eli now had to change and wash and clean and feed and all the rest. That wouldn't have been a help to Eli. But at some point, maybe when Samuel was 5 or 6 years old, it says after he was weaned, she took the boy with her, young as he was, along with a 3-year-old bull, which was the sacrifice, an ephah of flour and a skin of wine, and she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And then she talked to Eli, and she says this, "I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life he will be given to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. Can you imagine what it would have been like for Hannah to leave that little boy there at the tabernacle? Here's your clothes for the next year, okay? And I've packed you a little bit of bread and cheese here that'll do you for the next few weeks. And I'll see you next year. And she goes home. And in the story, it says that every year she came, she would have some more clothes for him that he could wear throughout the year as he grew. I'm sure that was the hardest day of Hannah's life. What if she had reneged? What if she had said, "Oh, you know, I was so upset when I made that promise to God. I really, you know, I gotta go. I can't leave my son there. He needs me. I'll let him serve the Lord when he gets to be 21. That's what I'll do. I'll give him a good upbringing and a good education. We'll do everything for him that we can. We'll teach him God's word at home. And then when he's 21, I'll say to him, 'Now, Samuel, you go and serve the Lord.'" What if she had done that? What if she had held back? There would have been no Samuel in the tabernacle. There would have been no word of God to Israel. There would have been no leadership for the people. Because of Hannah's devotion and commitment to her vows, God was able to bless her and all of Israel. And by the way, later on in the story, it says that God gave Hannah 3 more sons and 2 daughters. So she had 6 kids altogether. And then she could look at Peninnah and go, "Na, na, 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 na." Hannah's story is the beginning of the story of Samuel. It's an amazing story of unwavering faith in stormy times. Amazing story of a mother's example to her son of what it means to be devoted to God. You may be facing some uncertainty today. I don't know what kinds of uncertainty you're facing, what kinds of situations you have in your life. But I do know this, that Hannah's story and Samuel's story is a shining example to us of what it means to be true to God, come what may. Bev, would you please come up and lead us in our closing song? As we sing this song, it's a song about all that God has blessed us with, and the chorus uses the words, "Bless the Lord, O my soul." And it's a song of expression of trust and dedication and devotion to God above all else. Wherever you are in your life today, I would ask you, what can you give to God? We talked about that earlier, just a few minutes ago. What is it that you could give to God? What is it? Are there some storms that you're going through right now that are calling you to be stronger in your faith and more devoted to God? I don't know what situation you're going through, but I do know this, that like Hannah of old, there's a God who hears, there's a God who will answer if we call on him and pray. Let's stand together and let's sing. And if God is speaking to you and if there's something on your heart that you want to talk about or pray about, I would just invite you, come on up while we're singing this song. Meet with us at the front here. We have leaders here that will pray for you. And let's meet with God this morning. Let's sing. Bev?